The key linkage between the economy and well-being is through the labor market.
And in South Africa, that linkage has been under strain for 3 decades.
30 years after South Africa's transition to democracy, the labor market tells a complicated story. On the one hand, we've seen major policy reform, rising levels of education, and moments of real progress, particularly in the early 2000s, when both employment and earnings were increasing. But on the other hand, unemployment remains stubbornly high. Youth unemployment in the first quarter of 2025 was 62.4%. Perhaps most strikingly, racial gaps in employment and earnings have barely shifted in 3 decades, even as educational attainment has improved significantly. So what actually happened to South Africa's labor market since 1994? Which policies helped, which didn't, and why? And what do these long-run trends tell us about the deeper structural constraints shaping work, opportunity, and inequality today? I'm your host, Margot G., and in this podcast, we delve into the data. I'm joined by Vimal Ranshut, Professor of Economics at the University of Cape Town, to discuss new research that traces employment and earnings outcomes across race, gender, education, and sectors of the economy over the past 30 years. Welcome, Prof. It is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So before we get into your research, I would like to learn a little bit more about you. Can you tell us how you ended up as an economics professor? Is it something you always wanted to do?
I did not plan on this. I was a young student once upon a time. And actually, I really just wanted to explore the world a bit. And I had no funds, but I was a relatively good student. And so I applied for scholarships. And then in my honors year, I got a really cool scholarship to go and study in the U.S. And that was how it all started.
Wow.
And I went to the U.S. on what was that time called a Mandela Economic Scholars Program to do graduate studies in economics in the U.S. And then I came back and worked at WITS for 2 years. And then I went back to Michigan and did my PhD. And then I came back to do a postdoc here at South, and I haven't left.
What a beautiful experience.
Yeah, it was a bit of a random walk. But it all worked out, I think. It's a great learning, growing experience. Beyond the actual stuff that you're studying, the personal development is quite something you can't replicate if you just stay in your local environment.
Yeah, I can agree. What a wonderful story. And why is it that labor policy and the labor market matter so much to you right now?
I'll tell you what, I care about the labor market. I don't know about other people. For me, as an economist who's interested in development, the link between development, either as development economics, how a society develops, or as an individual, like if you frame it as how do people improve their well-being or their agency or their developments, their capabilities. In both of these regards, the key linkage between the economy and well-being is through the labor market. Of course, there are these other things, right? It's not to say, and we're quite careful in our paper to say that you can't divorce the labor market from the macroeconomy or from the monetary system. These are all interlinked. But in terms of people, it's jobs and wages.
Okay, so we are very grateful to have you doing beautiful research back in South Africa. And you did a deep dive into labor policy since 1994. So 30 years after democracy, many South Africans would expect the labor market to have become more inclusive. Has South Africa's labor market actually become more inclusive? And if not, why?
So in a big picture sense, the answer that we got was no, not really. I think there's probably small marginal groups where it has changed substantially. So people like me, for example, highly skilled professionals, I think we operate in a very different segment of the market to the majority of South Africans. But if you look at the mean or the median, meaning the middle of the distribution or the mass of the distribution, things have not improved substantially. It's not to say they haven't improved at all compared to 30 years ago, but not in the way that one would have probably anticipated or hoped for aspirationally at the turn of, at the end of the previous era and the start of our democracy.
Okay, and why is that? In your research, you look specifically at the employment and earnings as well as race and gender. What happened there?
So, it kind of, I mean, let me just explain first what we did precisely. We took lots of data, lots of mostly Census A data, and we created trends on this to look at what's the proportion that I employed out of different groups and what's the earnings or the wages that go with employment for different groups. And what we found were two things. The one is kind of promising in the sense that this is what everyone, it's been a policy endeavor to get more people educated, because if you could think back historically, one of the ways in which the previous political regime kept certain groups, Black people in particular, from developing was by limiting opportunities and access to education. And some of the big reforms in the 90s were about education. South Africa only makes schooling compulsory for everyone in the mid-90s, actually. And what we can see in our data is that the educational attainment levels increased substantially over the years. So younger cohorts now are much more educated on average than their parents were. And that part is clear. Now, as a labor economist, we would usually expect that this convergence in human capital or education as a proxy for human capital would result in a convergence in earnings. But we don't really find that. So that's both puzzling and perplexing, really, because it's one of the main avenues for social upliftment in development. And when we kind of analyzed the data, we broke up the reasons for why these gaps between groups, either male and female, or Black and white, or subgroups within the Black, and why these gaps have remained so persistent. It's because of a complex interplay of factors. The thing is that over the last 30 years, all groups have received more education or have attained more education. And simultaneously, the labor market in South Africa, but it, actually it's a global phenomenon. The labor market globally has rewarded highly skilled people much more, and the world has become more challenging for people without very high levels of education. And what's happened in the South African story, which brings the global statement down to a local reality, is that whereas for Black people, the increases in education were off a very low base. So now you're finding more and more finishing secondary school, whereas a generation ago, that was not even the case. Whereas for white people, the increase is happening, but more and more white people in younger cohorts now are finishing some type of tertiary qualification, right? So all groups are getting more education, that there is a faster increase amongst Black groups. So that's where the convergence happens in education. But the returns to education have been such that the returns have been very disproportionately concentrated on the very highly educated. And so despite the relative convergence in educational levels, the net effect has been kind of canceled out such that the gap more or less have remained stable between Black and white.
Interesting. Before we get into the policies that may have contributed to this or not, let's look at the other demographics that you considered. So you also looked at gender, and then you also looked at financial sectors. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Okay, so for gender, what we find is that South Africa has a significant gender gap in both, in the earning side in particular. Women on average have more and more education, especially amongst younger cohorts. You'll find that women are better educated than men. And this is not that unusual globally. But despite this, there remains a significant earnings gap. It has narrowed slowly. It has narrowed by a non-trivial amount, but slowly. So you start out with a large gap, and it's getting closer and closer and closer. So something that resembles parity, but it's still far from that. And it's been 30 years. So the gradient of convergence there is very slow. It's still a more positive story within the racial gaps that we looked at, because there we found no convergence in the labor market. Whereas with gender, it's something that's taking much more than a generation to happen. For completion, it's going to get completion.
Okay. So I hear you saying that South Africa is not different to the global trends where so women are more educated and the gender gap is decreasing. What is it that makes South Africa different?
South Africa is different in some ways. Our unemployment rate is the highest in the world of all countries where we have reasonable data. I know there are some debates about whether to believe our statistics, but certainly I believe them as a reasonable proxy of our reality. Because there's lots of other countries in the world which have substantial informal sectors, and we use international best practices in our surveys, and either no country is capturing it properly, or you have to make a very peculiar case to say South Africa doesn't capture informal activities correctly, whereas other countries do somehow, even though the survey designs are the same. That's quite a tough sell, actually. So what's different? Why our unemployment rate is so high? It's not much of an explanation for why, but in an accounting sense, in a statistical accounting sense, if you look at the rest of Africa, if you look at India, if you go to many countries in South America, what you find is that there's a large degree of informal sector activities. And in other developing countries, certainly throughout Africa, it's a mixture of informal sector activities and agricultural activities. Now, South Africa is peculiar in this regard because our self-employment in agriculture is very low, and that you could use our historical developmental experience, political development experience, to explain why there's very little agriculture. Subsistence level, small scale agriculture. The second part is the informal sector is much smaller here than in any comparative countries. And so these two things which keep unemployment rates low in the developing or emerging market countries just aren't present here. It is one of the ongoing questions why our informal sector remains so low. And I don't think anyone's got a very clear, like, a single compelling answer as to why.
So public debate often blames skill matches, labor regulation, or minimum wages, especially for youth unemployment. When we look since 1994, a lot of policies have been implemented. And when you look at this long-run evidence, what are the real binding constraints?
Yeah, I think there are some people who really believe that labor market is overregulated, and the additional cost and non-wage costs of engaging with labor is too high. I think there's a debate there. I think it may be part of our story. I don't find it compelling that it's the story. You know, I don't think that if you could solve the labor market regulation and make it more business friendly, you would solve unemployment. The reason for this is twofold. On the one hand, many other countries do have also labor regulations, right? And no country comes close to us in terms of our unemployment or our poverty and inequality. Well, poverty maybe, but not inequality. And secondly, what the academic research has shown, not by myself, but by a few others, is that there's a lot of non-compliance. I've done some work on minimum wages, and we find that usually half of the people in the low wage sectors are not earning the minimum wage, right? So if the argument is that the regulatory environment is so stifling that that's holding employment back, but half of the workers are not earning the minimum wage, then the two generate a puzzle at the very least, or contradiction. It's not easy to reconcile these two statements. When you've got regulations, but they're not being adhered to, then how is it at the same time that it's explaining these world-beating unemployment rates?
Yeah, interesting. So one thing you touched on in your paper, which stuck with me, is the growth of the financial sector. How does that fit in with the unemployment rate and the demographic outcomes you considered?
Right. So, I mean, one of the sectors that has done well has been the growth of the high-end services sector. It's not only finance, but it includes finance, but professional classes, let's call it that. And I know we call it that in the paper, but that's just the category which is used in the data. It actually includes a bit more than just finance. The thing about these is that that's been a big part of our growth, the services, high-end services. And they've done well, really, both in terms of performance and in terms of employment and growth. But these are highly skilled sectors which are not labor-intensive. So they're never going to employ millions and millions of people. And the people who they do employ, for the most part, are people who are not the people who struggle to find jobs. So, I mean, I guess it's important, despite what we showed, you know, I said that the relative returns have been vastly disproportionately in favor of very highly educated people, highly qualified people. But it's still true, no matter what, that the people who don't finish secondary school do much worse in our labor market than the people who do finish just secondary school. And they do worse than the people to finish a degree of some sort. On average, there are always exceptions, right? But so there's still an education gradient, and it's much steeper at the tertiary level. And so if the majority of our population is now falling into the high school or less than high school group, then your high-end services, including finance, are not going to absorb the bulk of that labor. I mean, it's fine. It's good for the economy. It's good for the tax revenues. It's not a bad thing in any way, but it's not going to solve a mass unemployment problem where the majority of your people are in a lower medium qualification or skill group.
Yes. And to the point of the high-skilled people, I would like to ask your take on the following. Firstly, as South Africa faces weak growth and the introduction of AI, what does this long-run evidence suggest for young people today? What message would you give the youth?
Well, I mean, I think people struggle and they try and they hustle and they get by how they can. I'm not too convinced that AI is going to disrupt the South African labor market, at least as much as in some other countries, because the big thing that they can do is they can automate an intermediate skill set of tasks.
Yeah.
You know, the things that could have been automated mechanically were already automatable by now. This new technology is shifting the frontier of where automation and therefore displacement can. So, I mean, it's a big unknown. Nobody knows, right? For sure. We all speculate and we all try to come up with quirrell theories. But I'm guessing that it's like your semi-skilled, medium-skilled workers in rich countries are much more at risk. Which is not a good thing for us. The fact that we don't have that much of that type of employment is not a good thing. And it's not also a good thing that some people are going to face serious stress in the environment. But if we're thinking of the aggregate labor market, I'm not sure it's going to be as disruptive here as it is likely to be in some places.
Okay. And then the second bit of advice I would like you to give is towards future researchers interested in labor market and the labor market policy. What advice would you give to students that are about to embark on this mission?
I would say students should work on things they care about. They have to understand or have a reason and personal motivation and drive to figure something out. I know that many students start the other way, and I was there once upon a time, as I explained. I wanted to travel, so I went, but then I had to do research. But it's much, much better and easier, and you do better work if you have a question which you care about.
So, Prof, for the policymakers listening to this conversation, if there was just one thing you want them to remember, what would it be?
The key thing in South Africa, in my opinion, again, is that we don't have enough jobs. And it's hard. I don't think it's an immediate thing that you can ask government to make jobs. The a government is limited by the fiscal space they have. That's just a fact. And there's only so many people that government can employ directly. They are, like, for example, in India, there's really big employment guarantee systems, which are scaled in a level which we can only imagine, but they're not dissimilar in principle from things like our expanded public works programs and community works programs. Those are important for people who are really struggling. They tend to give low levels of income for people who otherwise would have no income. They're not really what we think of as a flourishing labor market. The key thing and the key requirement in South Africa has always been we need more jobs, but where do more jobs come from? Jobs come from companies that are growing or companies that are being established, which in either case, for the most part, go with companies or people being willing to invest in a place, right? And that's what would be the key takeaway. But we try to engage with this towards the end of our paper, and we're very clear that we don't have an answer. I don't think anyone has an answer or the answer. That it's a complex thing, and it's such a long-standing and deep-rooted challenge in the society that there's no singular, like, this is what you need to do and you'll solve unemployment. But that being said, there's some things which definitely do need, and that includes stability, political, social, financial. It includes some degree of clarity on property rights, because nobody invests when there's too much risk. That's just how things work. Nobody invests if you think that your investment might be taken away or just collapse and become worthless. And, you know, one of the really cool things for me, and I think all economists would agree, even though we're a disagreeable lot, is that you can really see employment trends improving up till 2008. So the period from the mid-90s, roughly, for about a decade after the global financial crisis, was probably the longest expansionary phase in the South African economy's history. Well, certainly in living memory. I don't know what happened in the 1920s and 30s and those times. And you can see this very clearly, that employment is improving and improving and improving and improving. And then it sharply corrects after the global financial crisis and the country into a recession. So clearly that growth was correlated on a timescale with the long expansion. And after that period, okay, we had COVID, which it was nobody's fault. I mean, COVID was a global pandemic, right? But there was a period for a decade after the global financial crisis, roughly, where the trends are neither positive nor negative. They go up and down and up and down. They're more or less flat as a first order approximation. And those are costly moments, right? Because there's a generation of people who aren't entering into a growing labor market, into a society that's creating space. And that can be very challenging if you're young and you're unemployed, you're chronically unemployed, you're struggling to get into things. So I understand that there are lots of constraints and lots of considerations, but certainly we could potentially do better.
Yeah, lots to consider. And what I'm hearing is that there is no silver bullet and coordination is imperative. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I think the last few years have been quite impressive. I mean, I mostly just read the newspapers, so I'm not talking as an academic. But, you know, it seems truly, like when we wrote that paper a year and a bit ago, actually, we finished the first draft. And one of the things we ended with was, well, almost surely we need to solve energy crisis. Because that's one reason why firms won't want to invest if they're not sure that key component of production is too volatile. Well, since then, it seems like this company has turned it around and we haven't had load shedding in about 12 months, as far as I can recall. right? So that's kind of amazing. And from what I can gather, transport networks and transport infrastructure for goods, rail, and ports have also improved significantly in the last recent past. And so these are all great news stories if they're going to be continued and sustained. It's early, but it's really positive. And I think it's important to also recognize when things are going well or being turned around, because otherwise we can become so kind of nihilistic and negative that you don't even see when things are improving.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Prof. It is such a pleasure to have some time with you and to connect with you on our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Thank you so much. And thank you also to our listeners. If you'd like to learn more about this research, we will provide the links at the bottom of this page. It's all on the IRSA website. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our socials on LinkedIn. This is your host, Margot G. from the IRSA podcast series. Till next time.